Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I am your host, Alex Kessler. My co-host, Ben Bateman, is not on today, but instead we have Corbin Hausler tapping in, other sports words. Say hi to Corbin, everybody. Say hi to everybody, Corbin.
Yeah, hey guys, thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it. Getting ready, just watched the NBA Finals. Very sad by that, but at least I get to go to Vegas this weekend, so, you know, I can drown my sorrows at the craps table.
You know, just bet on other sports, right? There's other sports happening. Hockey's happening.
No, that ended, man. Penguins won. No.
Tennis? Tennis? Tennis?
Tennis, maybe?
French Open?
There's always baseball.
I think the French Open's happening.
That ended too, right?
Oh, no. I don't know. I Tebow everything. / don't watch
again.
Sports. Collectively. All right. So, today we're talking about a bunch of stuff. There was a crazy thing that happened this morning. Mark Rosewater wrote an article. It was an update to his last one. And basically, everything is changing. The whole world is in upheaval. We'll break that down a little bit. We also are doing a little bit of preview of GP Vegas coming up, which both of us will be at, as well as others. And I'll get into the shout outs in a second. And then last but not least, we are going to talk about a sweet Mardu Eldrazi list that Corbin was talking about, and he's going to break it down for us.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to all of that, as a matter of fact.
So, before we get on all of that, to get everything out, let's do some call-outs so that we don't interrupt the middle of the episode with call-outs. We just do it at the end of the beginning. Corbin, why don't you tell everyone where to find you, since you're new and everything else will be repetitive.
Yeah, I'm a lot of places. I do a lot of coverage. Event coverage for Wizards of the Coast. I do a lot of the writing. I'm the guy who types up all the deck lists, coordinates a show behind the scenes, all that sort of stuff. Content-wise, I produce Brainstorm Brewery, which is a finance/hangout podcast every week. I write weekly for TCG Player, where I also do a lot of the editing for the website. So I have a series called Mining Modern on YouTube that comes out every Monday, where I take modern decks and experiment. And I'm not really, you know, I'm like a good player, but I'm not a great player. So my pitch is never, hey, I'm going to show you how to be the best Grixis Death Shadow player in the world, right? But I'll experiment with something like Mardu Eldrazi or Tezzerator or Mono Red Tokens or, you know, something like that. So that's kind of that's what I do. And it's been a lot of fun. And I've been doing it now for, gosh, almost, I guess we're coming up on like a year and a half. So it's been a lot of fun, and the response has been really positive. So those are generally where I'm at. I write every month for Daily MTG. I just had an article that came out. We're recording on Monday. It came out on Monday. And, you know, obviously a lot else going on the website, so maybe got lost in the shuffle. But I focus on the community, and I wrote a piece about, you know, just highlighting some of the stories of the community of players who have been around for 25 years, because we're approaching the 25th anniversary next year. And I highlighted some of those really cool stories, including someone who, you know, when they were in elementary school, met Richard Garfield, and, you know, 24 years later has the oversized Black Lotus that he got at that event and signed by Richard Garfield, and still has all of that. So those are the cool kind of stories I like to highlight from the community for my work on Daily MTG.
Very cool. Where can people find you on Twitter, social media, any of that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Feel free to add me on Facebook at Corbin Hausler, but most of my interaction comes on Twitter. It's chosler88, chosler88.
And Mining Modern, you can find at tcgplayer.com?
Yes, or just, you know, YouTube Mining Modern, and it'll pull up for you.
Perfect. And then if you want to follow the podcast on Twitter, at the MMCast, I am at Cass Wiley. You can follow Ben Bateman, who is not here, at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter, and pretty much everything. Instagram, there's like Periscope, which I think is an app that exists.
that still exists?
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe it doesn't. I don't
never
know.
Never Periscoped in my life.
I'm now doing his shout-outs for him. So he also does a thing on an app called Anchor, which is he does 10 minutes of magic. So if you go to anchor.com or on our Facebook, we'll post the videos every day. He does a 10 minutes of magic content every day. You can check that out. Also, we're all going to GP Vegas. Corbin is working GP Vegas, so you will at least be able to wave at him across the rope during the thing, but also the Command Zone, our sister podcast, also on collected.company, is doing a whole big meetup on Thursday night. It's Thursday, June 15th at 8 p.m., ends at 2 a.m. at the Plaza Hotel. There's going to be a bunch of Commander, giveaway, prizes, foods, games. We'll be jamming some Modern. I might have a copy of the new game we're coming out this summer called Super Party Battle, and a bunch of other fun stuff. We'll be looking to see you guys there. So if you're at GP Vegas, make sure to hit it up. Beyond that, our Patreon, we are able to do this. We have these equipment that we are recording on right now. I'm able to do stuff like go to GP Vegas in the first place, so we can hang out with people because of it. So if you please go to our Patreon, it's why we can make this happen. Just donate anything from a dollar or above. It also allows you to participate in stuff like brew-offs where people submit their brews and we'll deck tech them on the show, and more. So make sure to check that out. And that's, I think, all of the shout-outs. And so into the day, big news of the day. There's Magic is completely changing again. So for those who
don't put it lightly,
those who don't know, a couple years ago or 2 years ago, I think exactly. So a couple, Mara wrote a big article where they talked about the problem they've had with doing three sets per block and how that third set would always kind of be less as good. And they tried doing new stuff. And so they went into what we've been currently living in, which is one big block, one small block, one big set per block, and then one small block. And then the block goes to the next one. And you can kind of see that with Kaladesh and Battle for Zendikar and Shadows over Innistrad and now Amaket. And they've still run into problems. And now they've announced that instead of two sets per block, they're just getting rid of blocks, and we're now just going to have three large sets a year followed by a core set, and yeah. And that's like 60%. So yeah, Corbin, what do you want to like kind of break down? Let's break it down each thing. What does no more small blocks mean?
Well, I think it means a couple things. One of which is some of the more expensive cards, and this is something maybe a lot of people don't necessarily think about when they see this, but some of the more expensive cards in Magic's history come from small sets. And the general idea is, this was especially prevalent in the three-set model of a block, right? Think of, let's see here. Let me think of a... Yeah, I would say I was trying to think of one that actually had good cards in it. But yeah.
Scars of Mirrodin block. So you have New Phyrexia exactly. with yep. the Praetors right. like Elesh Norn up to and including Gitaxian yep. Probe.
Yeah, and Vorinclaw. Yeah, that thing's insane, right? Even Git Probe was like $5. So yeah, so R. think R. about it. You know, Scars of Mirrodin comes out and you draft three of those packs for 3 months. Cool. Mirrodin Besiege comes out. Okay, well, it's one Mirrodin Besiege, two Scars for 3 months. Great. Now New Phyrexia comes out, and the biggest draw for Magic every year is when the new set comes, the new block came out, right? It came out in the fall. It was a new world. It was really cool, and that's when you got people back in. You know, that's when your casual players would come out to FNM a little more often. By the time you get to that third set in the spring, it's New Phyrexia. You know, some people are still invested. They're into it, but you open one New Phyrexia pack for 3 months in drafts, and that's it. And that was their lowest selling period as well. And that's right, you got cards that just were insanely expensive because it just wasn't drafted at all. It wasn't opened much at all. And also given that
– I mean, even in underpower sets like Dragon's Maze where the power level wasn't even that hard, you get stuff like Voice Resurgence ending up being like a $40 card because it was the only card in that set and no one opened it.
Exactly. And you know, making it even worse, they needed a reason to sell the third set. So what that often led to was pushed mechanics, which led to cards like, you know, your Sheodrid or your Phyrexian mana in the first place, which
Batterskull.
Is obviously a terrible thing. Yeah, all these really these overpowered cards, and it just compounded the problems and you ended up with really expensive cards. So it means that that's a product of small sets. And we even saw it sort of with like Liliana and which I think was an Eldritch Moon, right?
Yes, Liliana, Embercoal, Grimflare. Yeah. Like, if you look at the power level between those two.
Yeah, all those cards were $20-plus for a long time, or still are. Plus, Embercoal was pushed, partially for story reasons, but also partially because they needed to sell the second set. And it was expensive, and then it got banned. So there's a lot of issues surrounding that, and this probably clears up a lot of them, to be honest. I think that it is sort of weird to do away with it, and I worry more about the... you know, if you're taking people to three new worlds a year, that's a lot to ask people to get excited for.
Right.
But it does – that may become its own challenge, but this move does solve a lot of the problems they faced with the small sets.
Well, I think you get a lot of other like cool things. A power level or like, because you know before you're describing you know one set would be more expensive than the other. I think you'll have a little bit more of a flatter price differentiations between sets. It's not going to be, because like in your example, not only did you only open one pack of New Phyrexia, but you opened Scars of Mirrodin's packs basically from September until July. And now you're just going to open up for the first 3 months, and then the next 3 months are going to be a different set, and then the next 3 months are going to be a different set.
Right. It could lead to some flatlining. I mean, one of the points we'll get to later about Masterpieces may change that as well, but we'll see.
Yeah, and I don't know if it'll flatline. I think more it'll just put – it'll average everything out a little bit better, like the general value of a set. And we'll still have problems of the fact that the fall set's always going to do slightly better because it's people coming back to school and, you know, being able to do F&M every Friday after school and versus
– not going to the lake.
Yeah, versus
all of those things.
Everything from this point on in the year is, oh, it's summer break, so I can go play Magic, or I can go on this vacation that I'm going to go on, or summer jobs that don't let you get out, et cetera, et cetera. So that definitely, I think, has some effect on it. The other thing is just they, in general, and this is a draft thing, which is not modern-focused, but in general, drafting the two small set, one big set pack was always kind of just not as fun.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was definitely and this was something they said the research showed, that people liked doing the three-pack from the same set drafts, and I always did. I thought, say, using our example, New Phyrexia, Mirrodin, Besieged, Scars of Mirrodin was terrible, right? I don't want to do that at all. I actually thought it was kind of interesting with the two-set model where, say, Kaladesh is the best example, I think, because there were cards like I think the map was in there, like the Renegade map or whatever it was called. And like the, there was like a white card or something that could, when it came into play, you could bounce something. And in Kaladesh, they were just sort of, I can see some ways to use them, but they're whatever. Then Aether Revolt came out and it completely changed the evaluations of those cards in Kaladesh, because of the revolt mechanic. And I thought that was actually pretty cool, but at the end of the day, I'd still rather just draft triple Kaladesh. Or whenever you ask anybody about their favorite format of all time in draft, it's always like triple Innistrad. Triple Rise.
Yeah, it's never the only block I can think of, blocks that I can think of people saying, oh, it's their favorite, are like Time Spiral block and Return the Ravnica block, or not Return, Actual Ravnica block.
Right.
Partly because Actual Ravnica block, you don't get all 10, like it kind of really is just one set spread over three sets.
Right, it's just you see them differently.
It's like every set has the continuation of the cycles that they're trying to complete.
and also just for logistical things, it's a lot harder to draft two packs of one set and one pack of another set. Like, if I'm getting eight friends together to draft, it's really easy if we buy a box and we draft 24 packs and have prize support. It's a lot more complicated if now we have to draft two-thirds of this box and a third of this box, and now we're, you know, it's unbalanced, and now we have all these extra packs, and what are you going to do with them? Like, it just logistically, this solves that problem too, and that's a real thing for people trying to play on their own.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, we lived in a situation where even stores would have weighted balances on how many packs they'd have to just hold on to because we need to like have one box for every six drafts we do of Kaladesh because we only need one pack per player.
Yeah, it was just odd. And even if the experience on those were sometimes fun, it you know, this cleans it up a lot.
And from all
of these logistical standpoints, I think these are all very good changes. And I think there are going to be some new challenges that they're introducing, but I like what it's doing for most of this.
The other thing they mentioned, we'll get into the core set after this, because this kind of leads into it. But last year, there was a huge amount of fatigue during the summer because we had literally a new draft set every month for 5 months straight.
Yes. Yeah.
You started with Chekhov's Innistrad, and then it went right into Eternal Masters, which went right into Eldritch Moon, which went right into Conspiracy, which went right into Kaladesh. And just like, I literally felt like I drafted each set once because it just like was exhausting to keep up with everything.
Yeah.
And moving into this new system where they're going to move the summer set back to core sets, which has a lot of strengths to it, for both modern and for the game in general. It just makes it so like all of the content that they're going to start coming out with the summer is a little bit more easily digested.
Yeah, and it provides a path for people a lot. Yeah, last year I was actually kind of crazy, like just thinking back on it when you mentioned that. It's like it really felt like they were testing the waters. Just how many products can we put out and get people to buy them all? But yeah, moving to the core set now, you're right. It gives a sort of a break, a reset period there in the summer for people. And if they don't like a set, if they don't like the mechanics or whatever, it's only going to be around for 3 months. You don't you could just, you don't have to check out of Magic for an entire year or even 6 months now because you didn't like it. You can just take a break for a couple months.
It's 3 months, don't play or play constructed and not worry about the draft format, which is just way better for many different reasons. The other thing I wanted to mention before we jump past this is my biggest concern when we did the original jump away from 3-set blocks to 2-set blocks was kind of what you're talking about before, where everyone's favorite format is triple X, you know, triple Eldrazi, triple Innistrad, and no one really likes the multi-set blocks. There are a few 3-set blocks historically that are 3-set draft formats that you can draft that are really fun. I know no one that's like, oh yeah, this 2 draft. I've never heard anyone say like Scars of Mirrodin and Mirrodin Besieged. Those are that draft format. Those 2 sets
right,
are my favorite.
Yeah.
Like, there's been never really a window where, because it's always weighted towards one. You don't like, at least the with all three, you have this kind of even distribution of everything. When it's 2 and then 1, you're definitely a lot less
focused. That's true.
It's like a
I think that the only one I've ever heard like positive reviews on, and even if we count like Morningtide Lorwyn and Eventide Shadowmoor, I think Eldritch Moon Shadows Over Innistrad was the only one that actually got like really solid reviews.
Totally. And part of that was how different the second one was from the first one without feeling too like this. They did a good job of carrying over themes while drastically changing the environment, which I thought was really cool. But then they got rid of
Clues.
It's
probably their best success in the 2-block model, I think, was that set from a mechanical and flavor and gameplay standpoint, Emrakul notwithstanding.
I mean, definitely. I mean, Battle for Zendikar, I do give a lot of forgiveness towards. I think there's just big mistakes that were made, part one being that Oath of the Gatewatch should have been the first set.
that was bad.
But some of that was also them being like, oh, we have to smush this 3-block set into 2 sets. Go.
Yeah, and I think that that a lot changed with that. They were going through a lot of change right then, and you know, I think that there's no telling what that set looked like when it started out with them, as opposed to what actually got released.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. They deserve a little bit of a pass for that one.
And then Shadow of the Innistrad was great. I think they did a great job. And then Kaladesh wasn't bad in any way. It just was kind of neutral feeling. I don't know. And then what it did, and then Standard is a whole other conversation that I can't really speak towards. But
unfortunately, it will probably get sort of bogged down in history because of Copter and now Marvel. I think it's always going to be tied to that. But even vehicles were actually pretty bad in draft too. Like Renegade Freighter straight into Untethered Express.
Yeah, that's true.
They just didn't learn their lesson with Freighter, and they just printed another broken vehicle. Like, that actually ruined a lot of limited games.
Yeah, it's interesting how vehicles beforehand were definitely like, oh, is this going to be the next equipment? Are vehicles going to show up in other places? And then even for articles on Amaket, they're like, oh, yeah, we had vehicles in the set originally. And then they ended up cutting it. And it's like, because vehicles ended up being a little too strong.
They're hard to,
they're too strong, which is, and part of the issue is they're too strong because they've moved removal towards a sorcery speed pendulum swing. And so when the only way to interact with the vehicle is at sorcery speed, or is at instant speed effects or enchantment or artifact removal, you run into problems.
Yeah, and it gave every creature haste, so it made board wipes worse. And it was just sort of the classic mistake is they were a lot less interactive than maybe Wizards had envisioned in the first place. You know, same like Hexproof seemed great on paper and terrible in practice. Vehicles were probably sorted the same way.
Yeah, and I think
and energy is its own topic that had its pluses and negatives, and I think they sort of just missed the bar on what was fair energy costs.
Yeah, and I think that has a lot to do with just they have at most 20 people that are going to be paying attention to balancing this versus all of the world. And if they were to come back to an energy set, they would be slightly more able to gouge what is a correct amount of energy. But whenever you invent a new resource, it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard.
But
And it's
yeah,
like,
yep.
I give them a pass on, like, sort of they get a pass on the one hand. Like, I can understand how you could have gotten vehicles and gotten energy wrong internally because they are so new and so different. There's a lot to them. I can see that. At the same time, that actually sort of doesn't lessen the real world effect of what those things did.
True, totally, totally. And then I mean, we'll see what our devastation is going to be like. I very much like the first set, and I can imagine me like the mechanics that are in that set are also like all up my alley. It's cycling and three different flashback mechanic variants.
Right, right.
So like that's kind of what I want to be doing in Magic at all times, playing stuff out of the graveyard and or gaining value for free out of things.
Yeah.
So we'll see, but I'm definitely so far pretty hyped. And Nicol Bolas showing up, Desert Tribal, these are things I know will happen. I'm assuming some of these mechanics are going to return that I love, so
Yeah, Desert Tribal's sweet.
yeah.
That's just a nice little touch that doesn't really do anything, but it is cool.
Oh yeah, I kind of hope it's not super playable, but just it's I'm gonna be really happy. And maybe one there'll be a
Yeah.
commander that works with deserts, and I can play a desert deck in commander.
Well, it's the kind of thing that, maybe it doesn't do anything now, but maybe in Return to Amonkhet in 4 years, they go harder on the desert theme, and then all these cards are really cool,
Yeah.
right? So I just like it's just like a nice little Easter egg that may or may not matter,
Oh, and
right?
yeah,
And it's cool if it does.
and that happens all the. I mean, we'll be talking about Eldrazi later today, so that's like just a thing that can happen.
Yeah.
All right, so and then I guess yeah, let's get into the core set because I think that's also I think the most relevant thing to modern players beyond just what prices are going to be from standard sets moving forward. I think. We're getting back to core sets, and there's a few reasons that this is happening. One is in general, just people kind of missed them, I think, as just like a simple back to basics way to get anything. But I
Right.
think the two big ones is they needed an easy way to get new players into the game from a printing perspective and weren't able to really accomplish it. And then more than anything, they realized, oh, we can't reprint stuff into sets anymore. Or like it's way harder than we expected to get flavorful reprints into sets.
Yeah, I think when they originally did it, we originally made a change. They're like, yeah, we'll throw Inquisition of Kozilek like, and that was the example they used. Or, yeah, we'll throw Pithy Needle in. And to be fair, Pithy Needle could have gone in Kaladesh, but Inquisition of Kozilek, like they said, they explained in the article, just could not have fit into Battle for Zendikar or Oath of the Gatewatch at all, just by the way those sets were designed. And that you just don't have any, you have no valve to do that stuff outside of Modern Masters. And we've talked a lot about, hey, the Masters sets are the new core set, and to an extent that's true, but it's also just not enough based on the what those sets are. They're limited run. $10 MSRP, that's just sort of fundamentally different than getting a core set with just needed reprint with the Birds of Paradise reprint every year. Although I guess that's a bad example because they don't want that in standard. But that idea.
Right. Well, and beyond that, I mean, the other thing that I think is really important, and I think like because I think reprints were the first thing they kind of looked at, and then they needed a new player product. They mentioned in the article that they were designing a new player product, but it required them to create some type of limited product for people, new players to get into, and that just really didn't exist anymore, and it kind of made it so the product they were developing didn't work. And then the third one is what core sets were kind of always used for was great standard valves of. Like, oh, because the core set design schedule is a much shorter run. You can kind of
Right.
plan more based on what sets end up being instead of trying to predict, oh, we're printing, Kaladesh right now. We need to make sure we know ahead of time that this X, Y, and Z is going to be in the set. So we need to design this so it has valves for that. You don't know what that set's going to be. But a core set happens much shorter. So you'd be like, oh, we need Pithing Needle.
Right.
Duress needs to be printed in the standard. Otherwise, the standard format breaks in half. And
Yeah,
it's too late to fix
yeah.
half of it.
And I think one of the things I felt like reading the article, I picked up on it a few times. Before, when they moved from when core sets were all reprints, that made sense. They were what they were unexciting, but they put cards out there. Then they moved to the M10 through M15 structure. And that started off fine, right? Oh, we have some new cards, that's cool, but it's like a core set, but not. And I actually think some of the problems that they encountered with those is by the end of it, like if you read what they said when they killed core sets in the first place, is that they started to become normal sets. M14 and M15 weren't just core set light or, you know, core set with some new cards like M10 was. They were their own sets with their own identities and their own things. And I think a lot of it was internal. It's like whoever they put on in charge of that doesn't want to make a core set. They want to make their set. They want to leave their mark and,
right.
and really make it something that people remember fondly. And I think it just sort of naturally evolved from look at M10 and look at the cards in that. It looks a lot like 10th edition, but there's some new cards, but it's still fundamentally a core set. And you look at M15 and it's like, yeah, there's some reprints, sure, but that's, it's sort of fundamentally not what this is. It's its own thing now. And that led it away. So what I liked in the article is that Mauro was sort of very clear. It felt like that expectations are going to be different for the core set. The core set will not be expected to do as well as a normal set, and it will not be expected to pull that same weight. It's for newer players. And I hope that means that there's not going to be this internal pressure to design a really great core set. It's just going to be, this product is what it is. These are our expectations for it. You know, we don't need to push it every year until it becomes something different than what it was intended to be.
Right.
And if they can stay away from that, I think it's great to have it back. You know, it's great to have M10 back. I don't want M15 back or Magic Origins.
And I think part of that is, and I might be wrong on this statement, but I'm pretty sure that what they started doing with the M sets was letting the new designers, that was your
exactly.
first design lead. And so if you're a new designer and this is your first set, you get the design, you want to make it exciting, interesting, and to do well.
Right.
So the motivation on that person isn't to make a core set for what it's supposed to be. It's to make something that will allow the other designers to allow that person to lead a large set in the fall or a small set following up
right.
a large set.
Right.
'Cause that's just motivation. That's how people work. You know, when you're a new person trying to get to the top, you want to do the best you can. And a core set needs more like an old wizened person being like, no, we need to be calm and collected here.
Yeah. Let's get some real staple effects of Magic in here. Not let's design flip walkers that break standard. Or whatever, you
right.
know?
Right,
like,
totally.
It's just so fundamentally different.
And I think it'll be cool. It allows them to kind of do some of the revisiting, and then B, it lets them kind of do a little bit of a follow-up. You know, one of the things that they did really well, and Magic Origins did this, is visit planes that we're probably never going to see again. You know, we got
yeah.
a little bit more Lorwyn and Shadowmoor. My guess is in the future we'll get a Kamigawa revisit on a,
yeah.
in a core set
yeah.
where it's like, we're never going to go here. We get it. There's like 12 of you on the internet that are very vocal about how much you love Kamigawa. So here's Tomio's story.
Yeah, here's Tomio's story and 25 card names you can't pronounce.
But I definitely think it's good. I think the new player angle is really important. I think for modern players, this is the reprint necessary tool that we've kind of always been wanting. Now I think they've done an okay job. I mean, if you look at, there are a few cards that they haven't reprinted into a Modern Master set at this point, but if you look at all three sets combined, they've hit most major staples, especially
yeah.
if you look at what the staples were starting when the first one came out.
Right.
Like most of the staples that haven't been reprinted this yet, Scapeshift, ignoring Scapeshift and Curse Catcher,
right.
are cards that have been good this whole time. And so like the newer decks have offered new things and those haven't been reprinted yet, but that's something that can cycle and happen in the future.
Right, exactly. They obviously upped the bar a lot last year.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And the last thing we're going to see in general is, or I'm interested to see how they handle it, is do we get stuff like Lightning Bolt again? Because there was a period where the way they made M sets exciting was, here's a one powered card that was
yeah.
crazy cool and you get to play with it again. And how much they didn't want that affecting standard before. And they mentioned it in the article. I wonder if they're going to want to continue mentioning it or like
yeah,
continue
that's
effect.
True.
Like, yes, they said they're going to want reprints and that means stuff like Inquisition of Kozilek, which wouldn't have made it because of not power level reasons, but flavor reasons. Like we'll get the flavor reprints, but there's a whole power level reprint level that I imagine becoming an issue.
It's interesting because it can go both ways because it's odd because they've printed in the last few years in Standard, they print like these sort of clearly broken cards like Emrakul or Ulamog or Marvel or these things that are so incredibly powerful in the Standard context, even if they don't necessarily break Eternal formats or whatever, but then they won't give us, we don't get Birds of Paradise,
right?
You don't get Land of War Elves or whatever now. Yeah, I mean, it's like it would be really exciting if they brought back. God, it pains me to say to say Elvish Mystic, but so I'll say Birds of Paradise. but it would be exciting if they brought back Birds of Paradise or Lightning Bolt or anything. It's really weird because, like, objectively, the power level of Standard is both way higher and way lower than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah. I think part of it is they've done this huge pendulum swing towards creatures and away from answers. That you have this situation where decks are kind of allowed to do their thing. And when you don't have any valves on that, you run in, you know, the last 4-mana board wipe printed was the what it gives -4/-4 at all things in black. Oh, I forgot.
Languish.
Yeah. Languish. And then, Fatal Push happened. Like, and then Fatal Push was kind of their statement. Like, we want to get back to printing answers that are effective. And so maybe that'll start happening more and more, but it's definitely interesting to see what happens. And the core set allows them to kind of do that. The other thing a core set allows them to do a little bit better than regular sets is bring old cards into modern. You know, that's how we got Scavenging Ooze. That's how we got.
That's right.
So, it's like, a lot of those cards don't work in regular sets. And, you know, the valveness of a core set, where the fact that it's only there for 1 year, also allows them to maybe bring in a little bit more pushed things. Because hopefully it'll rotate quicker than normal if it's problematic. And you kind of saw that. I mean, that's the other reason I think Emrakul and Gideon and Standard were so bonkers powerful, and stuff in Kaladesh, is that they printed these sets or designed these sets hoping that, oh, these power levels might be a little bit more pushed on what we're doing, but we get to try some new things because they'll rotate quicker. And then halfway through, they're like, never mind, they're going to stay here for an entire 2 years.
Right. And yeah, so that's also a problem.
They like looked at Emrakul like, well, we can't – when this is going to be around for 12 months – because it was the second set in a set and it was going to rotate quicker, not as much of an issue. But now that it's going to be there for 2 years or an entire 18-month cycle, it's much more problematic, which they changed before. Now, I do want to get past core sets and move into them kind of walking away from masterpieces. And not fully walking away, but kind of their decision to – well, they said it. They're no longer going to include masterpieces in every set. They said they would previously, and then they realized after Amaket that there just aren't enough – available things to keep up at the rate that they were printing it at. So instead, probably my guess is, and they have no formal announcement on this, but once a year we're going to get a masterpiece set in one of the sets.
Yeah, it's honestly weird. Like, they haven't been around that long, right? It was Kaladesh when we got them forever, right? It's been 6 months.
Two
sets. Did they not see this coming?
And my
shocker, there's not enough good cards to reprint. Like,
yeah, I'm surprised A, they didn't just like list them all and like list ones they thought would be exciting, and B, why do 50?
Yeah, they did so many. Like, if they had just did like a third of that number and did less of the bad ones, he could have achieved what they wanted to achieve and still made them exciting.
Yeah, you could have done 10 to 15, depending on what cycle needs you might have, and do like five new cards. So like the five coolest cycle, the coolest cycle you're getting in the new set, and then five older cards, and then that's it. So 10 cards a set, five of them are new. So it's only five only reprints. And I feel like that could have lasted forever, but like, what are the 50 best artifacts in Magic? Yes. Eventually that list is going to get bore, the cards at the bottom are going to not be that good.
Right. So here's the problem with it, right? If they had just done it, and I had this criticism when they announced masterpieces with Kaladesh that there were too many. But the problem with it now is if they had done that and say we had 15 a set, that would have been sustainable and it would have given a baseline. Now we're, you know, we talked about the value of Standard evening out earlier, but one of the things that a lot of people may not understand about masterpieces, and I'll try not to go too deep here, I'll keep it brief, but when sets are in print, when Standard sets are in print, there's a cap on how much value the cards in the set can maintain.
So for everyone, did this, we discussed and explained kind of this as our entire episode last week. So,
perfect.
Yeah. So the whole masterpiece going away is really funny because we literally talked an entire episode about them and how they, or I think it was 2 weeks ago. But 2 weeks ago, we talk all about masterpieces and how they affected Magic. Go back to that one. That'll explain how they affect box value. But Corbin, do a brief description for people that didn't list that episode.
Yeah. Okay.
But,
yeah. No, that's great because it's a very deep topic. But the sets can only hold so much value. So, and that value has to go somewhere. So when masterpieces are in a set, they soak up a lot of that value. And because they're just cosmetic items, because they're all reprints, that value is directly coming off of the standard playables that you have to have. Because you don't have to have masterpieces, but you do have to have Liliana or whatever. So, you know, Liliana is like $30. Kaladesh, right? Let's talk about Kaladesh. Say Aetherworks Marvel is like an $8 card or whatever. whatever, because masterpieces soak up a lot of the value in the set. Without masterpieces, Marvel could have been $20, because that value has to go somewhere, and the value can only go so high. So if there are more cards in a set to hold the value, then it will spread out even. And since some number of those were going to be masterpieces that you didn't have to have, the cards you did have to play standard as a direct result had lower values across the board. And that's how you got really cheap standard lands over the past year and a half. So moving into a world where we only get masterpieces once a year,
ish.
I mean, we won't have the small set problem of cards being expensive, but we will have a problem where the average price of the standard playable cards you need from a set will vary drastically depending on the mass, whether or not it's a masterpiece set. And that could cause problems.
Yeah. Masterpieces, we talked about it, were great at lowering the price of standard. And that's kind of what, you know, everyone kind of wanted.
Yeah, that's what they were made to do. If you actually read between the lines of Morrow's first article announcing them, a lot of it was, we wanted to increase accessibility to standard. This happens, like, this is a way that does that, and it's all roundabout because they can't talk about
the secondary market
prices and everything. Yeah, and the secondary market. But it was there. If you knew what you were looking for, that sentiment is there, and it did exactly that.
Yeah, it's. And like when they did it the first time for Battle for Zendikar, I got it. Like they did a lot, and that it made sense because it was the first time they were trying it out. I really do think that like getting rid of them entirely is going too far. Doing it once in a while is going to be weird because we're going to be like, oh, why does this random set? Because its theme is on like, oh, we're going back to Theros, so it makes sense to have enchantment,
right?
Masterpieces, whatever they're going to call it, in this set, but not in this set, just because. You know, its theme wasn't strong enough, or we didn't think Return to Ravnica had enough space to do masterpieces, which, and the other end is, like, I was talking about it with Ben, and he pointed out, like, there's a bunch of commander cards, even, that if you came in an invocation for Niv-Mizzet, that card would be bonkers worth things, and people would be excited right. to open it, because it's, yeah, he's, like, a red-green dragon, or red-blue dragon, so it fits with Niv-Mizzet, so, or Nicol Bolas, or, you know, whatever, so, like, there are cards that you can make special that aren't technically worth something when they're not special. Like Ornithopter ended up being this, where by having a special version of it and it being a fan favorite or well-played card of a uncommon or common, it becomes worth it. And I feel like there's a lot more cards than they're giving credit to be able to accomplish that with.
Yeah, yeah. So the whole thing's going to be it's going to be really interesting to sort of study moving forward, right? To see what it does to standard prices and what it does to, you know, maybe reverse the gains they had made over the past year in price and accessibility. We'll see.
Yep. And the last thing, and we touched on a little bit, but now one of the cool things is that sets can, so they're getting rid of blocks, but they can have a set immediately follow another set that are related.
Yeah.
And so we talked about this a little bit 4 weeks ago, I think, when we did a, like, where we could go in the future in different sets. Like, what is a return to Ravnica look like? And one of the big problems we had with that set specifically was, how do you fit 10 guilds into a set and a half?
Yeah.
And we couldn't figure it out. And this answers that problem, is you'll literally have, you know, the spring set will, or the winter set will be Return to Ravnica A, and the spring set will be Return to Ravnica B, and you'll be able to do the full 10 guilds again, and everything is happy and perfect in the universe. But yeah,
it'll be cool.
And I guess the other cool thing was being able to do see a plane and then have the Phyrexian invade that plane immediately afterwards, or vice versa, go to New Phyrexia have them open the gate to Kamigawa, and then they destroy Kamigawa.
Yeah, you get basically like the Lorwyn Morningtide, Shadowmoor, Aventide sort of thing, or like the Khans of Tarkir, Dragons of Tarkir, where you can see the same place through a vastly different lens.
Yeah, yeah.
That is kind of cool.
Yeah, it'll be, I'm excited. I think A, I'm generally for trying new things, and B, it's interesting watching Wizards learn lessons from trying new stuff, and we've said it on this cast 1,000 times, is it's better that they're trying new things than I'm just doing the same thing every year, because eventually that stagnates and becomes boring.
Absolutely.
All right, now, next subject matter entirely. No longer talking about the big news, GP Vegas. Are you going to GP Vegas?
Hype. I fly out, what time is it? And I fly out in about 12 hours.
Okay. And I guess I'm going to let you kind of do a brief kind of explanation on what GP Vegas is.
Yeah. So Vegas is the first time that we've, it's not the first time we've gone to Vegas, and we've had the biggest events in Magic history in Vegas, but this is different because they're running three Grand Prix back to back to back, starting on Thursday. And I think it's Legacy. I don't have the order off the top of my head, but there's a Legacy Grand Prix, a Modern Grand Prix, and an Omicat Sealed Grand Prix. And one of them starts on Thursday, runs Thursday, Friday, then Friday, Saturday, then Saturday, Sunday. And it's, you know, if you don't make, it's kind of brilliant because if you don't make day two on Thursday of the next, of that GP, just sign up for the Friday GP. Give them all your money, right? It's,
yeah, if you're,
it's
if
a
you're,
lot going on.
If you're either not great at Magic or like not trying to day two every day, you literally could just play in a different GP 3 days in a row.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, it's Vegas. I don't know how many people they're expecting, but they're expecting a lot of people. I know all the vendors have been planning for this for months. Like, this is going to be blown out just like the last two Vegases were. And the first Vegas, I remember just being crazy because no one knew what it would be. And I remember I road tripped out there with some friends, and we were just watching the ticker go up on the people signing up, and it was like 2,500. Wow, this is not 3,000. What? 4,000. Oh, my God.
Right.
And then, you know, they actually were like 5,000 or whatever people, and it broke Wizards Event Reporter. And they, the scorekeeper, Nick Fong, who's incredible at all that stuff, had to basically save it from the back end because the stuff had never been built to handle all of it, right?
Right, right.
So Vegas 1 goes down to just all this lore. So then Vegas 2 happens, and it was essentially sort of the same thing. And it was awesome. It was a lot of fun. They'd learned the lessons. Cascade Games ran that one. And it was a good event. And now, so this year Wizards figured out how to make it even bigger. So there's going to be a lot going on. Channel Fireball has a lot planned, with guests out there. You know, all your favorite podcasts, YouTubers, all of this stuff's going to be going on. So it's going to be pretty nuts.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, the second Vegas felt very much like the classic sequel, where it was bigger, had a larger budget, was more flashy, but then maybe wasn't as unique and special. And then
he didn't have the, like, remember that I was there for that sort of feel.
Right, exactly. And then this one's going to be a whole, I mean, it kind of is a reboot. It's a whole kind of new game. It's interesting, too. I wonder how many people, I feel like this one is going to have a little bit of a different feel, though, because before the other two, because they were the Modern Masters, set was the limited format, you had an environment that people had to play in. It was like, oh, this is the only time ever in the history of the world that this set will ever be a GP format.
Right.
Not to mention, I have the chance of like opening foil Tarmogoyfs plus other crazy stuff in this format and just, you know, doing really well. And this is going to be different. So I feel like this has the chance to being the closest thing we're ever going to get to a like where Blizzard has BlizzCon to like WizardCon.
Right. Well, that's exactly what I was thinking about. You know, this is, it could be viewed as a dry run towards this sort of thing in the future.
Yeah,
you know, maybe in the future they decide that this giant thing, and if they decide three GPs are the way to get people there, maybe that's what they do. But you know, it could be a blueprint for this sort of thing in the future.
Yeah, just doing a bi-yearly kind of their own Comic-Con big convention where it's more about the convention side, and then you just use the three GPs as a framework or skeleton to kind of build around it. Since Magic is a big tournament game. But, you know, like, I'm not playing in any of the GPs this weekend, even the Modern one, because I'd rather just hang out with people, meet people, play a bunch of side events where, like, I'll be able to play as much Modern as my heart can dream of, but I don't have to make any real commitments, which means that, like, it's more of a, and we're in Vegas, so it's, you know, there's a lot more versatility in being able to just to go and hang out with everyone and participate. I think it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are for the actual tournaments, because, you know, to go to Comic-Con, you have to either be a professional or spend $250,
right,
I think,
money
to just get a ticket. And eventually maybe that's what this convention becomes, is there's a GP, and maybe GP entry comes with entry to the convention.
To the whole thing. Yeah, that could be true.
But then, you know, individuals that don't want to do that, just like, here's $250. Maybe you get a few side events guaranteed or something along those lines, and then you just get to have a fun time. But I'm super excited. I mean,
I like a world where that's a thing. Like, I went to in GP Vegas 1, I played, and I made the top 32 of the tournament, which is, you know, that's great. But I missed out on so much. I was like, man, you know, I just spent my whole weekend playing Magic. I guess I messed up.
Totally. No, yeah. I mean,
so I really am okay with a world where it becomes a convention, a 4 or 5 day convention that happens to have some tournaments at it.
Yeah, I think, and it's something I've wanted GPs to become for a really long time. It's one of the reasons I loved GP, not Denver or Dallas, GP Detroit, because
with the escape room.
Yeah, with the escape room, it had the Avacyn restored, or the Shadows of Innistrad escape room with the giant church that Avacyn was in, and then in other parts of the world there were other different escape
rooms.
That was
fun. And I was there for that. That was awesome.
Yeah, it was the most convention-y kind of one of these felt, and with, like, to the extent that I was even able to talk a friend who does not play Magic at all to go to it, because he was like, oh, I'll go through an escape room.
Yeah, right.
And so, like, the more stuff like that, the more, like, this one, I'm, like, really stoked on how many panels they're going to be and how many content creators are kind of doing their own different events. Speaking of which, go to the Command Zone one. And subtle plug, you can find all the information on Twitter. it's sweet. I'm super stoked. I think it's going to be a giant blast. And I think it's going to be the event that could really change the tide on how Magic deals with these big community building events.
Yeah, and they've been, we've been subtly moving to that. Like you said, the escape rooms at those, and it's, they haven't done anything like that since. So I don't know what we're supposed to take from that. But just also, even like the prize wall is a thing. So it's not just about, it used to all be about the Grand Prix, and that's what you did. Inside
right.
They were there. You got some packs, but now like the prize wall get introduced, and that adds a whole nother thing to a weekend. A lot of people go get the like pass to play all the side events they want and don't play the main event. And more and more artists are at shows now, and that's a thing. And yeah, this is actually a pretty cool idea for future events to really bring out more players than just the people who, because playing in Grand Prix is very intimidating to a lot of people.
Oh yeah, and there's a ton of Magic players that would say, oh, there's a Magic convention in Vegas. I'm completely down to go that. That the fact that, it's a Grand Prix, I don't want to go play in a big tournament. That's not really what I want to go to do. And they're not going to go.
Right.
And when you change that culturally to more of a social giant hanging out event, you're going to end up with, I think, a more rounded kind of player base, which is kind of what Magic has become. 10 years ago when I started playing Magic, the Magic celebrities were pretty much exclusively the pros and Mark Rosewater.
Right.
And since then, there's just been a lot of content creators, both of us included, but just that aren't, like, I could never take down a pro tour. I've never even qualified for one. So, but I like to talk about Magic. I have, and a lot of these communicate, like, the Professor wouldn't win a pro tour, but he's one of the most followed Magic people. So it's moving a little bit beyond just straight tournament play and a little bit more about just a community, which is what it's kind of always been about anyways.
Of course, yeah, and Wizards deserves a little bit of credit for finally catching on to that, because for people who don't know, Magic is sort of always been supported by the casual player, right? Your F&M attendance is what it is, and compared to the number of people in your city who have played Magic at all, it's very low. The big box stores sell product to people who go home and play and don't ever look up the rules, don't ever go to channelfireball.com or tcgplayer.com or follow Magic on Twitter. They've never turned on Grand Prix coverage, but those people play and buy Magic cards, and Wizards gets a large part of their business from them. And to their credit, Wizards has done a really good job over, I'd say, the past 3 to 5 years of actually connecting to that and reaching out and working with someone like, the Professor or Mana Source and bringing them and making it about not just the pro game and sort of highlighting the other parts of the community.
Right.
And that's done a good job at growing it, because it's not just about the tournaments, even though that's kind of what the company's focus was for a really long time.
And to gain the legitimacy that they did and the reason that Magic has existed for almost 25 years is because, in the early years, they decided we're going to focus on the pro tour as our marketing thing versus this, because it allowed basically whales, and not in like the negative way that that term is used in app development, but in the sense that, these players are going to play enough to kind of designate their life towards it, that, and then through them, they'll convince other people around them to also be a part of this community. Sorry about that doorbell ring, but we're definitely on the verge of Magic community becoming more of the center focus. And I also think that's a little bit why this change was made as far as core sets go, is it's a little bit better at kind of being a focus of where you know, new players and bring, you know, that's kind of what Wizards always kind of have to bring itself back to, is retaining and gaining new players, because eventually players leave or stop playing. So if, you know, you're not growing, you're dying.
That's exactly right. Exactly what I was thinking, actually.
And this convention effect is a bigger, as a PR thing, is a more, almost even more impressive, just because you now have the ability to show, oh, here is what this is going to look like. And this is what you could be a part of, instead of, oh, you could be the best player. Most people aren't like, oh, I'm going to be the best Magic player. But most people are like, oh, I'd love hanging out with a bunch of people and playing a bunch of board games for a weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going to be it's going to be fun. I know that.
Yeah, and then so I think that's kind of it for GP Vegas, unless you have anything specific you want
to
bring up.
No. Oh, I guess, to see everyone out there.
Yeah, and as far as the modern part of GP Vegas, any guesses on what deck would you bring if you were to play in the GP?
So I think objectively the correct answer is to get good with Grixis Death Shadow and play it right. That said, I think that the big decks going in, sort of, if I were to name a big four, 3 to 4, you know, it's Grixis Death Shadow or Death Shadow in general, Eldrazi Tron, Dredge, and Counters Company, which I think it's Abzan Company.
I don't know why it's called. Do you know why it's called Counter Company? You're behind the scenes on that level.
I mean, it's because, like, the word counters is coming from the fact that it's a counters. You know, it prevents the counters from being put on. But I think what happened is when it came out, people naming the deck wanted to differentiate it between the traditional Abzan deck. That said, there is no traditional Abzan deck anymore. Abzan Company deck anymore. It's all devoted to
right.
Like, that is the new deck. Like, this is the new Abzan Company. If we didn't need to name it something else when it added Renegade Rallyer, we don't need to name it something else now. It's just Abzan Company, and we just need to go back to that. But that's my personal take. But those are the big four decks, right? And I think that means there's going to be a lot of ways to a lot of, like, ceremonies, rejections, and a Grixis Death Shadow sideboards, for instance. I think there's going to be a lot of Anger of the Gods. There's going to be a lot of Gravedigger's Cages, and possibly even more Graveyard Hate because of Dredge and Counters Company. But I think you can expect a lot of Cages this weekend. So pick a deck that has something good against them. Death Shadow is the right choice. As much as I want to say Merfolk, because that's my thing, I'm not going to say that. I also think Storm is not a great choice because of all the Cages. What I do kind of like under the radar as a result of this is Living End.
Sure.
Because people are going to be playing Cages. I think if you look at those decks, the only one of those four decks, and you throw in Burn and Infinity, right? Those are the other big decks, or even like your Scapeshift decks. None of these decks play Rest in Peace. You have to go down to Jeskai Control and Eldrazi Taxes, stuff like that. That's a smaller percentage of the metagame before you run into Rest in Peace.
And even Jeskai Control avoids it because Snapcaster Mage is a card.
Right, exactly. And Living End does not care about Grafdigger's Cage, because the way Living End works is the cards get exiled from your graveyard and then put into play because all the other creatures get sacrificed. So just the wording of the way Living End works actually completely dodges Grafdigger's Cage. A lot of people don't necessarily realize that. So I think the Graveyard Hate of choice this weekend will be Cage. Living End doesn't care about that. By the way, Living End has good matchups against Tron and Counters Company. Dredge maybe not so much. Grixis Death Shadow, I think, is actually an okay matchup. And it's, you know, it's fine against Burn or whatever, right? So I think that is sort of my under-the-radar choice for the weekend.
So it's interesting because I think you'll be proud of this. If I were to pick a deck walking in, I think I'm going with Merfolk.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a few reasons. One is that Death Shadow has a significant amount of time. Oh, sorry, this isn't coming out correctly. They have a problem beating Spreading Seas.
It's true. The Grixis versions are a little better with it than the Jund ones were, but yeah, you're right.
And then beyond that, just the fact that, as you mentioned, the Graveyard Hate is going to be out in Stride this weekend, and being an aggressive deck that doesn't care about the graveyard being there or not is something that I think is really easy to take advantage of.
That's true. I mean, you know, I don't like the Abzan matchup much with Merfolk. That's the biggest thing that scares me away from it.
Sure.
Tron and Dredge are, like, Dredge isn't great either. Like, they conflagrate you. You're in a lot of trouble. Tron is fine, right? I'm okay with that matchup. Walking Ballista is good against you, but you have Spreading Seas. Death Shadow I'm fine with. But I don't like that Abzan matchup with Merfolk. That said, you know, it's modern.
Right.
You know, it can be this – you can play against that deck 0 times in 15 rounds and do well because – that's just how modern works, no matter how good it is.
And that was the other thing I want to remind is metagaming a GP is generally not especially in Modern, is rarely going to pay off as much as playing a deck that you're already really comfortable with.
Right, exactly.
Almost every time I've been like, oh man, I'm playing this list and it's like really good against these top three decks, and then I play maybe one of them for the first entirety of day one, and you're just like, oh right, I should have played a deck that like can beat 8 whack.
Right.
So like, just really playing a deck that you're comfortable with, you're good at, and is just kind of going to be, in general, something that you can win with, is going to be a better move than being like, oh, well, this deck has a great Dredge counter company and Grixis Shadow matchup, so I'm going to play this one because I'm going to play those once. And plus, it's to have fun. So that's the Modern half of it. Oh, speaking of, I guess this is something that's been going around on Twitter because of the Core Set Edition and because a beginner's-focused, you know, smaller version of a core set is not going to make the best Pro Tour. Do you think there's a chance that the Modern Pro Tour comes back?
I had not thought about that. I don't think so, but I hope so. I'll say that. that's probably the best I can do. I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I think this
Modern's probably a better format for it being gone, though.
Right. I think this is a conversation probably we'll do a whole episode on in the future, so we'll put that in the thing. But just everyone keep that in your little docket of things to remember or think about is, does, what are the benefits and negatives of a Modern Pro Tour? Yeah. All right. Now, last but not least, Mardu Eldrazi, Deck Tech.
Okay, so Mardu Eldrazi, now everyone's seen a bunch of different versions of Eldrazi. But what I did is I saw, and this is from Grand Prix Dallas in the middle of last year. I think Cody Lingelbach, I believe, is the right way to say his name. But he played black-red Eldrazi to like a top 32 finish. And I looked at him and played it, and I was like, man, so the deck has a lot going for it, right? Because you get to play discard in it, which Bant Eldrazi does not get to play, and you get to play Lightning Bolt, and I hear that that card's pretty good, and you get Kolaghan's Command, which is also a pretty great card in Modern, and I played the deck, and it certainly was powerful, but I just found myself missing Eldrazi Displacer so much. I was like, you know what, I'm gonna start messing with this. So I started working on this maybe 6 to 9 months ago, and I recently picked it up again in the new metagame and tested it out some more, and I've had a lot of success with it. 5-0 to League the other day. I've had several 4-1 finishes in competitive Modern Leagues with it. But it looks a lot like other Eldrazi decks, right? You have Displacers and Wasteland Stranglers and Thought Knots and Smashers, and that's always going to be good. But what you get in this deck, like Bantle, you lose Draenor, which is a big deal, but you get Wasteland Strangler in black. But more importantly, you have fewer bad matchups than something like Bant Eldrazi or even Eldrazi Tron, in my opinion, because you have so much flexibility. You know, you get to play 4 to 5 discard spells in the main deck. You get to play more in the sideboard, right? So that by itself helps your combo matchup in a way that like something like Bant Eldrazi just kind of gets rolled in game one. You get Lightning Bolts, you get Fatal Pushes, you get Path to Exiles, you get Kolaghan's Command, which is great for grinding. So you have a lot more answers than like the Bant Eldrazi deck does, or the Eldrazi Tron deck does. And you also have Lightning Bolt to Kolaghan's Command, which can go to the face to help finish people off. At the same time, you retain some of the better parts of Bant Eldrazi. You can displace their Thought Knot, lock somebody. You can just power out fast Thought Knot Seers. This deck runs Mind Stone and Talisman at the 2-drop spot to enable more turn 3 Thought Knots in the same way that Noble Hierarch does. You also get a main deck 4 Relic Virginitas because you need it to turn on your Wasteland Strangler. But also it turns out it's just a great card right now in Modern, and being able to main deck them and cash it in when you need it, but just gain a lot of percentages in game one just by virtue of having it, powerful.
People are using their graveyard for value in this format? Is that
go figure, right? and it's so good because in the decks, against the deck where it's bad, right? Say it's just like, let's say Merfolk, right? Just sort of your generic creature deck. It may not do much, but if you are able to just exile whatever their fetch land and then Wasteland Strangler their creature, you just basically beat those decks on the spot with Wasteland Strangler. The card's just so good. Also, by the way, we're playing, you know, Bolts and Pass and Fatal Pushes, so those decks are not a problem. You know, I will play against those decks all day long. Something like Blue-White Control or Jeskai Control can be more of a problem for our deck than sort of the creature matchups. But overall, you get access to the best sideboard cards in the format. You get Rest in Peace, you get Collective Brutality, you get Anger of the Gods. You just get all of the good. You get, you know, your choice of Artifact Hate as well. You get access to just to play the best cards, and in a really good shell where basically you play these control elements with these discards and removal spells and Stranglers, and then your end game is Eldrazi rather than just having the Eldrazi end game like Tron or Eldrazi Tron, or just trying to ramp into crazy Eldrazi like Bant Eldrazi. You get to play out like a control deck that has Eldrazi finishers. And it, in my opinion, it's not that the deck is necessarily, say, more powerful than Bant Eldrazi or Eldrazi Tron, but it gives you more game against more decks, and you have fewer lopsided matchups where you just, you know, either are behind. And I feel like you gain a lot by having that in modern, a format where you can play 9 different decks on day one of a Grand Prix.
So what would you say the top 5 key cards of the deck would be?
Well, so your engines are like your most powerful cards when you play them are Displacer, Strangler, Thoughtknot, right? And that's sort of a given. After that, I would say it's, you know, some number. The current list I have is 2 Path, 2 Pushes, because I'm just not sure what the split should be, and then 4 Bolts, right? So you're, and then the 4 to 5 discard spells. So those, you know, those 10 to 12 one mana spells sort of form the rest of it, because that's your game against a lot of decks right there. So there's a lot going on with this deck. It has, you know, a good late game, a good early game. It has, as you'd expect from a 4-color deck, the mana base takes a little bit of work, but I spent a lot of time tweaking it, and I'm pretty happy with it, even down to the 2-mana rocks we play. Another piece of the deck that gets lost a little bit, but is actually very powerful, is Hangerback Walker, because it fills in the 2-drop spot. But also allows you to grind out. And like I said, the deck plays out a lot like a control deck. So if on turn 1, you Inquisition them, turn 2, you play Hangerback, turn 3, you kill whatever their play was, or play Relic, or whatever, or you just sort of take control of it while booting up its Hangerback. And then you start slamming, you know, if they burn something to deal with it, then they get Thought-Knotted, then they get Reality Smashered.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, and it's just got a lot of the whole of the package works very, very well together, and I've been happy with it across the entire spectrum of matches, and that's what I want out of a deck in Modern, is that I feel comfortable with it against anything I might sit down across.
And then what would you say the sweetest play in the deck is?
Sweetest play, probably things involving Kolaghan's Command, but Wasteland Strangler's up there too. I mean, so many games just end because you just play like a turn 2 Wasteland. Like turn 1, you play a Relic, exile their Fetchland, and they play like a Mana Dork. Turn 2, you just like play a Temple and play a Wasteland Strangler and kill their guy. Next turn, you play a Displacer and blink your Wasteland Strangler and kill a guy. And the game just ends.
Yep. That seems really good.
Yeah, and like in late game grindy situations, there's also a lot of sweet plays where you like Thought-Knot them, and they have 2 removal spells, right? And they kill your Thought-Knot, and you get one of the removal spells, and you're like sort of playing that game, but more or less they handle the Thought-Knot, and then you're just like, okay, Kolaghan's Command, make you discard a card, buy back my Thought-Knot at the end of your turn. You play my Thought-Knot, get your last card.
Oh man,
Kolaghan's
that's
Command
sweet.
Gives the deck a lot of reach.
Right. Well, it gives a lot of decks a lot of reach. The card's really good. Someone was commenting on like Stoneforge Mystic, maybe, because someone else I think brought up unbanning a bunch of fair cards, and they were like, Stoneforge Mystic is too good. And then the comment after that was like, Kolaghan is laughing in the background.
Yeah, that is true. I still think Stoneforge Mystic is too good, but it is true that there are more answers than there used to be.
Right. I think, I don't know if we're quite there yet, but I think every year that goes by, there's better and better ways to kind of handle the card. But that's a whole other conversation. So the last thing we want to do with the deck tech is, and if people want a deck list, it will be posted alongside in the episode on collected.company. But we're going to do a gauntlet. We're going to walk this deck through what I have put in as the top 6 plus a deck that I think Corbin is pretty familiar with. decks to see how he thinks the deck would do against them. So let's start with the first one and probably the most dangerous, Grixis Death Shadow.
Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely the hardest matchup just because it's the best deck. It's not that it's particularly good or bad against you. Honestly, you're kind of playing a similar game with a different end game. You both want to remove their early plays and tear apart their hand. The difference is their late game is to play a big Death Shadow or whatever, and maybe sometimes turbo it out. And ours is to drown them with Eldrazi. And I feel fine about it, right? It's pretty heavily dependent on key cards, like whether or not you get to Thought Knot them, and whether or not you get to take their Death Shadow before it gets big, or whether they just run away with the game. They certainly have more potential to just – they have more broken draws than you do, right? Because they can have the turn 3, 9-9 Death Shadow that just kills you. So, you know, that is what it is. At the same time, we run a lot of cards that deal with it. So I would say this is the toughest matchup, but it plays out just two grindy decks you know, running into each other, and whoever can basically keep the threats off the table best is going to pull out ahead.
All right, next, Burn.
Yeah, so this is actually an interesting matchup because the mana base of this deck, being four colors, can sometimes deal itself a lot of damage. That said, I'm 5-0, I think, against Burn in the past 2 weeks on Magic Online. And Burn has a lot of trouble with just getting their first play negated, whether that's from a discard spell or a removal spell, and then getting Wasteland Stranglered on their creature, and then getting Thought Knotted, and they're just out of stuff. And then, you know, in our sideboard, we're playing white, so you get Blessed Alliance and Collective Brutality. And Collective Brutality is obviously the biggest blowout, because we all know how good that card is. Kill your Goblin Guide, take a Burn spell out of your hand, drain you for two. So, yeah, I've not had any trouble with Burn, although Burn is, of course, a good deck that can always kill you. I feel pretty comfortable with that matchup.
All right, next, Counter Company.
Yeah, no, this is kind of the dream. I love this matchup, right? I love this matchup. You get to mess with their hand. You have a million removal spells for them. You get to mess with their Eternal Witnesses because your main deck in Relics. You get it. Wasteland Strangler is great against them. Displacer is great against them. Like, your deck is just so good against them. Your deck is made to kill little creatures, and they're a deck of nothing but little creatures. So they basically have to have a crazy draw where they just are able to combo you off very fast, or have multiple collected companies that you're not able to strip out of their hand or something. And then after sideboarding, you get Anger of the Gods and Rest in Peace if they're playing the Obzon version with Kitchen Fink still. But also Collective Brutality is great against them as well, because you get to kill a creature and take their collected company. So I will play that matchup all day long with Mardu Eldrazi.
It's crazy to me that Collective Brutality was the fourth most played card at GP Copenhagen.
Yeah, it's so good. It's one of those people complained a long time about Modern being a bunch of broken decks just trying to do their broken thing against each other. And it was like, well, how do you design cards to fix that? And I don't know if it was intentional on their part, but they actually did it, right? Collective Brutality and Kolaghan's Command are probably two of the best examples. Blessed Alliance is another one as well. And just because they're modal, they're good in so many situations that they stop you from just randomly losing to stuff. Like Blessed Alliance stops you from randomly losing to Boggles, which is a stupid deck that sometimes pops up in Modern, and it's a real thing. And it feels really bad to have your nice tricked out deck and then lose to Boggles because you can't interact. But cards like Blessed Alliance and Collective Brutality and Kolaghan's Command that have so many modes, but at the same time aren't aggressive cards, they're control cards, really has shifted Modern away from being, you know, quite so much broken decks relying on being broken and trying to dodge specific sideboard cards, to sort of, you know, interactive magic in a sense. And I love that the cycle of modal cards they come out with in the past year and a half and what it's done for Modern.
Yeah, it's kind of evolved the format to where, you know, Legacy blue is the best color and every deck is playing that. And for a while, I would say that green was kind of the most comparable in colors. But I think black has kind of cemented with Fatal Push, with Kolaghan's Command, with Collective Brutality, with obviously Thoughtseize and Inquisition of Kozilek and Liliana. You have kind of this control suite of fair cards that does what Force of Will does. Those cards all
exactly
do what Force of Will does in Legacy. And so it allows Modern to have a little bit more of a fair format than it ever kind of has had access to.
Thoughtseize has secretly been the MVP of the format since its creation, right? It's the only way to police anything.
And there's a reason that Jund has always been a tier one deck. I mean, even after having two key cards banned out from under it, it just is always going to be something that's going to do something, because having Thoughtseize in your deck as a 3-8 of is really important and powerful and fair. Next on the list, Dredge.
I haven't played this matchup a ton. I honestly don't know exactly how.
Wait, pause really quick. It's recording, but Ben has 5 minutes and said he wants to call in to Skype.
Sure.
So we're going to add him if I can figure out how to do that. All right, so I just got Ben on the line. Say hi, Ben.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm so excited I caught you between things. This is exciting to be here.
You're interrupting our very thorough gauntlet of Mardu Eldrazi.
Adding to the gauntlet.
I like the idea of Mardu Eldrazi. That's not a deck I'm super familiar with.
It's sweet.
It sounds
great.
Sick.
Have you ever wanted to play all the best Eldrazi cards? Because you get to.
Right, no, it sounds like it. And because you're playing red, do you also get to play that sweet one-drop spell in Modern? What the heck's that thing called?
Yeah, I think something about a Lightning Bolt. It's pretty good, as it turns out.
Yeah, I'll bet. Do you get to play Kolaghan's Command? I don't even know why you would.
It turns out you do play Kolaghan's Command because it's just a broken Magic card. We were talking about rebuying Thought Knot Seers with it and making them discard a card.
That sounds like 100% my style. I got into a whole thorough conversation with Alex last week about ranking the 10 commands.
yeah.
And believe it or not, I actually fought for Kolaghan's Command over Cryptic, which Alex was like, you are a fool.
What's the worst one?
The red one, actually. We agreed the red one's the worst.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
But I was wrong on Primal Command because I didn't actually realize, and this is just a general Magic card ranking, not even like a modern ranking, but what I didn't realize is that you can target any player's graveyard for the reshuffle, which makes the green one infinitely better than I thought.
Well, that's true. Also, it's actually seen more competitive play than ones you might think are better, right? Than like Austere Command or whatever. Because the green one makes the infinite loop with E-Witnesses.
Right. This is true. My like secret one that I have like an affection for is Profane Command, and I think I'm the only person that like truly loves that card.
It was played in Standard, right? It was cool for back then.
It's a big Standard card, but it's just never expanded beyond it, except for in Modern decks that I build.
I added it in three of my Modern Masters 2 draft sets, and it won me every game I cast it.
I know, but the proof of how worthless that card is to you is the fact that the foil you opened is now in my possession, and I can't remember what I gave you for it.
I probably just gave it to you.
Yeah, that's exactly proof. Case in point. All right, I'm derailing you guys.
So yeah, what in a tweet or less, what did you think of the big news today?
It's huge. On 10 Minutes of Magic, my little station on anchor.fm, the app you can download, which you can find me on every day, I did a whole bit on it. I recapped the whole thing.
We already plugged your anchor station.
Did you really plug it without me here?
Yeah.
That's really nice of you. I think it's really interesting. I think that there's I actually thought of all of the things that they said in the announcement. The big block structure makes a lot of sense, because if you think about like a lot of when you ask people what their favorite draft formats are, it tends to be like triple Innistrad. It tends to be triple Rise of the Eldrazi. It's large sets, triple set. That is very often what you hear from people. But on top of that, the Masterpiece announcement, the fact that they're scaling back Masterpieces and then giving us some new version of a core set, I like both of those announcements. Because you and I talked a lot about this on the show 2 weeks ago about the whole printing of Masterpieces and how it's interesting, but it's also like already the invocations felt a little bit disjointed and like they didn't make as much sense as you wanted them to. And the idea of just keeping going with that, I'm glad they're going to scale it back because they should feel special. The Expeditions were like a real grand slam for a reason, because lands are ubiquitous.
All right, now I think what we came to is that they should have just been doing 10% and like 5 reprints and 5 new cards, but yeah, that's I think we're kind of all on the same page a little bit. And then last but not least, how hyped are you for GP Vegas?
Oh, I'm so hyped. I'm like stressed right now because all of my like media work got pushed into a day today because I'm about to be gone for a week. And, like, I just covered this premiere, and I've got to go and, like, whatever, meet some people right now. My flight's in the morning. I have to, like, go home and do, like, entire packing for, like, work stuff, and then 3 days in Vegas in, like, the course of a couple hours overnight. Like, and I'm just as well as thinking about things I have to pack, like suits, I'm also like, how many Magic card decks do I need to bring?
Right there with you, man.
Right? I'm like, do I?
It's four. One for every format.
I think those of you that have been listening to us for years will be excited to know that I have committed. I'm building a Commander deck, and I will have it.
Wow.
And I will be playing Commander games in Vegas, and it will be with Brea, and it's a whole deck, and it's going to be sweet. So
yay.
There you go, guys.
All right. So on that note, Ben, say bye to everybody. Let us finish Scotland, because I think you have to go.
Okay, thanks for listening, guys. Go see The Big Sick when it's out. It's the movie Judd Apatow's producing, Michael Showalter. It's really good. I really like the premiere,
I've had two. What? I've had two different people, and on top of that, an ex-girlfriend, all randomly message me over the last 3 weeks to tell me I look like the main character of that movie. Whitney doesn't.
Numel Kanjani, the guy, or what, the guy from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, apparently I look like him. I don't.
You look Pakistani. I've never gotten that.
I've. Thank you. Or not thank you. I don't know. It's. I don't know if I look like him.
Well, it's great, and you'll like it. You'll like all of the things. It feels like watching an Apatow movie, like a classic Apatow, Knocked Up or something like that. Anyway, guys, thanks for letting me get on the call and ruin the fun you were having. Corbin, thanks for doing the show, and
yeah,
I'll be back
man.
For the full episode next week. And I'll see you in Vegas. I can't wait for Vegas. I can't wait to meet everybody listening to this in Vegas. I am so hyped for this convention. So,
bye, Ben.
Yeah, man, absolutely. See you later.
Bye, guys.
All right. That was fun.
That was awesome. Yeah. If you have more of those call-ins, that was great.
It's something I wish we did more on this podcast, and maybe that's a question for everyone. Would you guys like us if we just did random call-ins in each episode, if possible? And yeah, because I think those are fun. like a radio show. He's like a regular person, and that by he's the host. But like you're like a regular person that you could just call in and be like, I think this about this thing, and then just drop out. And we get like crazy characters. This is what happens on radio. all right, now moving on. Dredge.
Dredge. I actually haven't played Dredge a ton. I'm not sure. It feels like it wouldn't be the worst because outside, it feels like Conflagrate's probably the card that makes or breaks it. Because once you get a good enough board position, they can't really, like, unless they just have a great draw, they're not going to overrun you with Bloodghasts or whatever because you can just sort of handle them. That said, we do run a lot of removal and discard that they're more or less immune to. So I imagine game one is certainly uphill. Game two, you get a couple Rest in Peace, a couple Anger of the Gods, maybe Slaughter Games if you want to go that route, and you have some shots, but overall I'd have to test it more to be sure, but I imagine it's certainly in their favor just given how many of our cards are bad against them in game one. That said, we are main decking for Relic of Progenitus, and so it's probably very swingy in that you can just steal games with that.
Yeah, I feel like your deck, the four main board relics seem like, you know, anytime you're running main deck hate against a deck that's entire plan at a tournament is to guarantee win game one and then lose the sideboard hate, but hopefully they'll eke one out in game three if they don't draw it, is definitely in your favor.
Yeah, it's just weird, though, because, like, we could also just draw the four lightning bolts instead.
Sure.
And, I mean, maybe four bolts will be fine, right? But maybe we draw the fatal pushes and some bolts in like, Wasteland Stranglers or whatever instead, and then they just sort of, like, run you over because you just didn't draw the right card. So it's probably actually very variable.
Sure.
But like I said, the best part of playing Mardu is you get access to all the best sideboard cards in the format.
Right.
So you do have recipes in your sideboard as well as Anger of the Gods.
Yeah, like you start, yeah, yes, main deck, you just start with like four cards that are good and then everything else isn't. But then you go up to a total of at least, what, nine almost?
I would say at least like eight cards that are just insane against them.
Right.
And then, like, you know, others that are good. Like, because you still have, like, your main deck still has, like, Thought Knots and Displacers and Smashers. You can still just kill them.
Yeah.
And you can buy time with, like, you can also just, like, Displacer Blink, set up a Blink on Strangler and just kill their Amalgams forever. You know? So, like I said, it feels like Conflagrate's probably the important card for them if they can't overrun you very quickly to actually stop you from getting a board that answers them.
Sure.
But like I said, you know, I think that game one's probably still a little in their favor, but I would not be scared to sit down from Dredge with this deck, knowing that I actually have the ability, unlike a lot of decks that maybe look like Mardu Eldrazi, I actually have the ability to win game one rather than just looking at my sideboard.
Right. You're just like, oh, okay, I'm going to let you kill me while I look at my sideboard plan right now.
Yeah, and obviously the sideboard is what you make it. Right now I have two Rest in Peace in there and two Anger of the Gods, but like, you know, I have like Crumble to Dust and EE and an Inbringer and a Slaughter Games and stuff that can just be cut to go up to more Rest in Peace and more Angers, and then you obviously love that matchup the more of those cards you have.
Right, and there's just random cards you like. There are random versatile sideboard cards that you're randomly throwing, like a Mardu or not Mardu, a Rakdos Charm or something like that. Where
right,
it's like,
exactly. Yeah,
oh, this card just it exiles a graveyard, but I'm playing it for these other two effects, and so there's definitely a lot you can get kind of. Red and white are probably the best at eating graveyards after artifacts, and you have both of those things and artifacts.
Yeah.
Okay, next, a little bit of the mirror match, Eldrazi Tron.
Yeah, Eldrazi Tron, it's sort of it plays out similar to Death Shadow. It's about who can actually resolve the biggest threat. And they have the ability, they typically have the ability to go over the top because, you know, they actually play some of the, if they draw their Tron half of the deck, you can be in trouble. And you have some, you definitely have cards that are pretty bad against them in game one. That said, you can still just like get, you can still just get them, right? You can still just like Inquisition, Thoughtseize, into Displacer, into Thoughtnotseer, and then play Smasher and kill them, you know?
Right. Well, it's kind of why like decks like Jonder, or more important, like Merfolk, where it's like, even in bad matchups, you can sometimes just draw the hand of turn one Merfolk into turn Merfolk, turn two Lord into turn three Mirror Regery into turn four, a bunch of things that let me play my whole hand, draw six cards, play my whole hand again, and then I swing at you for 12, and you're dead.
Right. And in this matchup, it's like if they draw, you know, if they have two Karns and Tron, you're probably going to lose, right? Because you have Inquisitions more than Thoughtseizes in the first game, and you have these Lightning Bolts that are meh, and you have these Fatal Pushes that are, like, pretty bad. But, so, you know, in that sense, they probably have they're probably advantaged, but it's slight. I think it's slight because you also are just playing powerful cards of your own.
Right.
So I'm much more scared of the Tron half of their deck than the Eldrazi half. And I don't particularly care about their walking ballistas at all.
You don't like going on long walks with ballistas in the moonlight.
I don't mind Fatal Pushing, Pathing, or Wasteland Shrinking laying their ballista on turn three and beating them down. That's for sure.
That's fair. I'll take that. I've been messing around with Walking Ballista and Teleria West recently, and it's very enjoyable.
Oh, that's a fun one, actually. Yeah.
I'll show you the list in Vegas, and other people get to see it when they go to Vegas. All right, next and last of the main gauntlet is Affinity.
This is pretty easy. As easy as anyone is against Affinity. You get to play Kolaghan's Command in your main deck, which is great. Displacer's really good at messing up their Cranial Plating draws. And even their Seal Overseal draws, right? If you have enough mana, we're playing, you know, four discard spells, four Lightning Bolts, and then four Path/Push. So you can just kill all of their creatures, and you have Kolaghan's Command and Wasteland Strangler to clean up. So it's like you path their Seal Overseer, then you Strangler their next play, and then they just like probably don't have enough gas to kill you unless they have a nice plating draw. So I'm pretty fine with that matchup. You also, and like I said, this is one of those weird matchups where Hangerback Walker can come in handy, even if it involves you killing your own Hangerback Walker to get tokens to block Signal Pests or whatnot.
Sure.
So, you know, Affinity's Affinity. It can obviously kill you at any point in game one. But then after sideboarding, you get Shatterstorm. At the moment, I have a Shatterstorm in there. But you get that. You get Anger of the Gods. You get EE. Engineered Explosives, and your deck's already like adding into the cards that are already good against Affinity. I'm as comfortable with that matchup as anyone really can be against Affinity.
Well, I mean, and back when both Affinity and Infect were like tier one and decks you needed to worry about, there's a reason that Lingering Souls was so good, and Hangerback
yes.
Walker does kind of the exact same things in this matchup, where it's like,
yeah,
if you can block a X1 flyer, you're going to be much better off than they normally would be, because they just can't get past that, and any attack that they make into you is really unprofitable for them.
And while we're on the subject, a lot of people brought this up. I have zero Lingering Souls in the deck right now because the 3-drop spot is full, right? There's not very many 2-drops. It's just a couple of rocks, a Dreadbore, and then the Hangerbacks, right? But the 3 has the full set of Displacers, 3 Stranglers, a couple Kolaghan's Commands. So I didn't, like, I didn't see putting in 4 Lingering Souls there. It is entirely possible and perhaps likely that cutting some of the extra stuff in the sideboard, like I could just look at my sideboard right now and cut, cut Crumble to Dust, the 4th Reality Smasher, the Inbringer, and like the Shatterstorm or the Engineered Explosives, play 4 Lingering Souls, and you have them to board in then against control decks. That you're boarding Wasteland Strangler out against. So basically against a control deck, I could board out 3 Wasteland Stranglers in a Fatal Push or whatever,
right?
And board in 4 Lingering Souls straight across. And you also could then have Lingering Souls against something like Affinity if you wanted it, or any of those attrition matchups. So there's a lot to be said with it, and I would have to do more testing to really nail it down. But I don't have Lingering Souls in the list I've been playing with, but it is entirely possible, perhaps even likely, that it is correct to have it in the 75.
Right. Right now, I've had a lot of good success with the card, just from the perspective that, like, there are not a lot of trampling threats right now, and there are a lot of things that, you know, you gain up if you're able to block their 9-9 with your 1-1, worst-case scenario. And then you have stuff like Affinity, where it's like, oh, I can't beat that card.
Yeah, like, it's really weird, and I basically determined, and this was wrong, like, sort of my initial determination was, if you don't want Lingering Souls main deck, you don't want Lingering Souls. But I don't know that that's true.
Sure.
Because I think that, like, in the dark, I'd rather have Wasteland Strangler against the current meta. But, like, Lingering Souls is just so good, I think it's probably correct to make room in the sideboard for it, which then, you know, just requires tinkering around with the numbers a little bit. Like, if I were trying to take this to the Grand Prix this weekend, like, I would probably cut some of the, like, there's cards I like, right? You know, I enjoy Crumble to Dusting people. It's nice on Magic Online to get them, but at the end of the day, it is probably just worse than having four Lingering Souls and just boarding into Lingering Souls. So, you know, if I was going to a Grand Prix, I would definitely find room in 75. But right now, I haven't figured out what's correct to cut, so I haven't made any of those moves.
Yeah, I mean, like, and even decks like Jund, which, you know, yes, Death Shadow versions of Jund are going to be more popular than maybe just regular Jund. But even with that out of the way, like, people are just going to play their Jund deck, like, because they've had it forever, and that's what they're good at. And Lingering Souls is really good against Liliana of the Veil, and Liliana of the Veil is generally going to be a good card against Eldrazi because you have less, most of your threats are big one-offs instead of a bunch of little things. So yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And then I guess the last deck to kind of talk about is Merfolk, mostly just because I think it's funny. They'll make you kill two of your children.
Oh, yeah, I know. I love Merfolk, but yeah, this deck crushes it. Sad to say. you get a discard their best card. You have a million removal spells, like an actual million removal spells. Basically, if you ever play Wasteland Strangler against a Merfolk player on turn two or turn three, they lose the game on the spot. I remember when Black-White Eldrazi first came out, I had a friend who was building it and honestly did a lot of work on it himself before it was popular. And I played just like 8 games in a row against it with Merfolk, and I won like one of them. He just played Wasteland Strangler, and I would just cry. I'm like, okay, there goes my Lord. I don't have Island Walk. You get a trade with another one of my guys. You've already made me discard 2 cards. Like, okay, I lose. Yep, this just crushes Merfolk.
Sorry. It happens.
Yeah. And then you board into Anger of the Gods, too. It's just all the feel bads.
I feel like if you're good against Affinity, Merfolk doesn't get harder.
Yes, that's such true. Unless the reason you're good against Affinity is all Ancient Grudges, then yeah, it's going to carry over to Merfolk.
Yeah, I guess like the reason Jund is good against Affinity is not the reason it's good against Merfolk. You have, you know, four multiple main deck Call Against Command, plus you have Ancient Grudge in the sideboard versus Merfolk. Right. That's not as good, but I still think.
Yeah. And Jund Merfolk is already like super grindy.
Yeah,
like, it's already a weird matchup that I don't actually like playing for Merfolk side, even though the win rate is decent.
Sure.
So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Mardu Eldrazi sadly does crush Merfolk.
All of its dreams. All right, so that's it. That's all the gauntlet. Any last words on the deck?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely a deck that has legs in Modern. I do a lot of decks on Mighty Modern that, and I try to be very clear about not hyping decks up to be something they aren't, because I don't like that, because you have to be cognizant of the fact that people do base their buying decisions on the things that you say or do when you have an audience, you have a responsibility. And I think that this is a real deck in Modern that has had success. And while it certainly has tweaking to go, you know, in the sideboard or the mana base or any of these things, I think that this is a deck that you could take to a Grand Prix and I'd feel just as good playing this at a Grand Prix as I would Bant Eldrazi at a Grand Prix right now. So that's what I can say about it. I think this is a real deck that is good, and it doesn't have any. It has some matchups it crushes. It doesn't have as many free wins as some of the other Eldrazi decks, but it doesn't have as many bad matchups either. And that's, you know, that's what I like in Modern decks.
Fair. All right, so that's it for the episode, guys. First off, thank you again, Corbin, for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thank you for the opportunity. It's always fun. I love Modern. So any chance to hang out and talk about it is great.
I know, it's the best. everyone else, you can find both of us at GP Vegas this weekend if you're going. But where can people find you if they're not going to GP Vegas, or if they want to find you after and or before that?
Yeah, absolutely. Hit me up on Twitter at chostler88. You can Google Mining Modern on YouTube. Also, I'm on TCG Player every Monday. And my podcast, Brainstorm Brewery, comes out on brainstormbrewery.com and on iTunes and all of that good stuff every Friday. So that's everywhere I am at these days.
Which, speaking of which, and getting into a little bit of the Patreon thing, if you donate to Patreon, you can get a Lifelinker code, but or the Lifelinker app, which is a life counter thing, but you can also get a Brainstorm Brewery and a Monsters of Modern background on that app. We're both part of the Lifelink family of podcasts and other content creators created by Jimmy and Josh, the guys behind the Command Zone. Both of us are at collected.company. You can follow us, the podcast, at the MMCast. I am personally at Cass Wiley. Our call-in for the day at Ben Bateman Media. And on other things like Facebook, Instagram, make sure to check out our Facebook. We're trying to do more content there. In fact, Ben has been posting his 10 minutes of magic every day there. So we do every day there's new content on that page. And you get to talk to us in person. I'll argue pretty much on any social media, but on Facebook or Twitter about anything if you want to challenge us to some discussion, debate, etc. And thanks, you guys. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Once again, thank you, Corbin, for coming on, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Thank you for your attention. See you later, alligator.